Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about maximizing energy and dollar savings in your home. If you're about to buy a new appliance or remodel your house, upgrading your heating or cooling system, if you're like most of us, we don't do this very often. When you want to make a good choice, both for your pocketbook and for the environment, this book, The Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings, 9th edition, can help. The Consumer Guide will help you make wise investment choices and help you decide which products to buy and how to use them for maximum energy savings. We'll talk about that with Jennifer Thorne Amon, who's a senior associate in the Buildings and Equipment Program at the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. She's one of three authors of the 9th edition of this Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings, which is published by New Society Publishers. Jennifer, it's a pleasure to have you back again.
Thanks, Jim. It's great to be here.
You may recall that the 8th edition was a thank you gift in one of our previous pledge drives, and we appreciated your being on with us for that.
Oh, yes, I sure I did enjoy speaking with you before, and I hope that everyone who got a copy of the book found it useful.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the history of the book. It was originally co-produced with Home Energy Magazine, I understand.
Yeah, that's right. You know, some of our staff here at ACEEE, we've had a long friendship with the folks out in Berkeley and with Home Energy Magazine. And so starting in 1990, we decided to take a number of smaller information sources that have been put together by the Massachusetts Audubon Society and a number of other organizations that covered energy efficiency and different products in the home, and combine those and update the material into one book, you know, kind of a guide for all of the energy-using equipment in the home. And so since 1990, we've had we've updated the book regularly, so we're now in the 9th edition. There have been some big changes. We've added quite a bit of material, changed some of the layouts. And here in the 9th edition, there are some pretty substantial changes from the 8th edition, where we've kind of reflecting how energy use is changing in our homes.
Mm-hmm.
And the different equipment that we have. So we've added a chapter on ventilation and air distribution, recognizing some of the interests that people have in improving the air quality in their homes, and concerns about how air quality might be impacted in a highly efficient home, a very tight home. And we've also developed a full chapter just on home electronics, because they are becoming a much larger part of the overall home energy picture.
I understand that as much as maybe 25% of the home energy use is involved in personal electronics.
It certainly is in some homes. I know I have some very tech-oriented friends that have some pretty elaborate entertainment systems and other products, and it can certainly add up. And at the same time that we're getting more and more efficient with the use of some of the more traditional energy consumers, you know, people think about their heating and cooling system, all the major appliances in their kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, we've made some really great gains through just innovations in the technology, the actions of establishing minimum efficiency standards at the federal level, and then the efforts by the utilities in the states to really promote high efficiency products. We've really kind of ramped down the energy use of some of those products, but the gap has been filled with all of these other new uses that we're finding pretty typical in American homes.
Jennifer Thorne Amon is our guest from the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, otherwise known as ACEEE, or ACEEE, something like that.
ACEEE.
ACEEE is how you would say it.
That's what we lovingly call it.
And if people would like to join the conversation, all you have to do is give us a call if you're in Madison at 263-1890 or at toll-free 1-800-642-1234. Let's talk about the contents of this book. You start off with a home energy checklist for action. And what are you asking people to do there?
Yeah, you know, we put together this checklist because I know, you know, if you tell people, oh, improve the efficiency of your home, it can be quite a daunting task to figure out where to start and what can be done when. So we've laid out a simple list of things that you can do, kind of low or no-cost measures that you could take on yourself in the next day or week, and then move into what you might want to look into doing over the next month or over the next year that might require you to call in a contractor or, you know, may require a little bit more investment if you're talking about replacing an appliance or upgrading your heating system. So those might be things you need to plan a little bit for in your budgeting. So really some items to get you started right away, and then things to think about in your planning.
Well, let's talk about things that we would do today. For instance, turning down the temperature of your water heater to 120 degrees will save some energy and avoid scalding your hands.
Yeah, that's true. And this is often a recommendation that's made, particularly for people who have small children in their homes, where the scalding incidence is much higher. So, but turning down the temperature of your water heater, many times the water heater will have a warm, the settings in, you know, warm or hot instead of in temperature. So it's usually around the warm or just below the warm setting is around 120 degrees. And then another thing that you can do kind of along the same vein that would save you energy in your water heating is using energy-saving settings in your dishwasher and clothes washer, washing clothes in cold water as much as possible. All of those can save substantial energy from your water heater.
Mm-hmm. You have mention of incandescent lights and surveying those to replace them with the compact fluorescents. Is it just price that is the determining factor here in whether people are going to replace their bulbs?
You know, I think it has been price, but we've seen prices drop substantially in the past few years. And so now, you know, there are compact fluorescents available at very low price points, probably not as low as incandescents, which can cost, you know, maybe less than 50 cents a piece. The compact fluorescents are still going to cost you a couple dollars. And it's just a couple of other things I think that are that kind of limit people. Some people, you know, adopted compact fluorescents maybe 10 or 15 years ago and were kind of turned off by the technology. So I really would like to encourage folks who fall into that camp to go out and try some of today's new modern CFL lamps. Their performance is much improved. They no longer have the flickering that that I think people noticed in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Their color rendition is much better. You have a variety of products to choose from. You can get lamps that give off light very similar to the incandescent lamps you've used in your home for years. But some people prefer lights that are more like daylight lamps that give off a cooler light, and you can get those in compact fluorescents as well. So you can look for either the regular ones that might be labeled warm white, or you can look for daylight lamps that'll give off a cooler lighting. But, you know, it's a little bit confusing. We offer some information here in the book to help people pick out the right wattage of lamp.
Okay.
It's kind of confusing because for years we've bought lamps. You know, we all know the familiar wattages that incandescent lamps come in. We know we want 60 watt. Or we want 100 watt, where we need a lot more light, and we kind of know what to expect from those measures. Whereas when you're buying a compact fluorescent, of course, the wattage numbers are much lower and are different. But really, what we want out of a light bulb is lumens. So I think, you know, it's going to take a little bit of education to get people used to thinking about lumens instead of watts.
And that's contained in the book, though.
We have a chart to help. And also, if you go to the stores, most of the manufacturers on their packaging for compact fluorescents will let you know what the incandescent equivalent is. So you might see an incandescent that says 15 watt CFL, and it'll say on it 60 watt equivalent. So that can help people out. But we also have a chart in the book that can help you figure out what you might want to look for when you go out to the stores.
Jennifer Thorne Amon is the Senior Associate in the Buildings and Equipment Program at the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, one of three authors of the ninth edition of the Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings, published by New Society Publishers. You can find out more about that at the website for the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, which is aceee.org/consumer guide. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right. Let's go to the phones and take some calls. Again, if you'd like to join us, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Ken in Michigan. Hi, Ken. What's on your mind today?
Yes, good morning. I'm really glad to hear a program about this particular situation. I recently moved up here to Upper Michigan. We're in the snow belt. It's cold. It's snowy all the time. I bought a house up here and retrofitted it, basically a lot of insulation, a lot of new windows, a lot of new doors, all Energy Star appliances, new high-efficiency propane furnaces, and the like. And I'll tell you what, the payback on it has been outstanding. I've got probably a $30 to $35 electric bill here per month on a 1,300-square-foot house.
How are you heating that?
I heat with propane in a high-efficiency 96-plus furnace.
Mm-hmm.
I do also heat with wood backup. You know, on, I've got a fireplace that I throw wood in the fireplace.
Sure.
And so forth. But the fluorescent bulbs, the pigtails, I guess I call them, but the high-efficiency fluorescent bulbs and everything else that I've purchased has made such a big difference. I used to live in West Dallas, and I used to use a suburb of Milwaukee, and I used to use regular appliances and everything. And I was paying $70 a month for electric bills. And due to the fact that I'm using all these high-efficiency appliances and everything else, I'm now cut it in half, and I'm in a colder climate, and I think energy efficiency is going to be the way to go. My automobile also, I've gone from a large truck to a small compact truck, which is 30 miles to a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's going to be the wave of the future. We're going to have to with the $3.30 a gallon gas prices up here that we're paying.
Jennifer, I'm sure that you would applaud what he's done.
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad to hear it. And I'm sure with all of the work you've done with insulation and new windows and so forth, Ken, you're probably really comfortable in your new home as well.
Very much so. It's nice and warm. I have a question, though. I do have a lot of stereo equipment and, you know, electronic equipment, and I did see something about that, about, you know, unplugging all your stereos and everything because they're drawing energy. Now, I don't want to do that because they're going to lose all their memory.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is an issue. And so what we typically recommend is one thing that you might want to do, if you have, you know, any equipment that you're not using on a regular basis, you would want to unplug. If you have some components, if you have a system where you have some components that have the memory and some that don't, if you want to take the components that don't need to be on or plugged in all the time and maybe just put those on a single power strip and you could just at least flip the switch for those products. If you use a power strip that has a switch on it, when you turn the switch off, it really does cut all the power, and you won't have those standby losses. So maybe that would be an in-between step that you could take, kind of take whatever components don't need to maintain a memory and cut those off. The other thing that that I've done in my home, I know I've got a system with a TiVo and all that kind of stuff, and we've put that on a power strip. So at least if we're going to be away for the weekend or a longer trip, it's very easy to just flip that switch as part of the, you know, final run through the house before we leave.
Ken, thanks a lot for the call and good luck, and we appreciate hearing from you. Let's go to Aaron in Milwaukee next. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, what I wanted to know, and I know a little bit about this, but I know that other people aren't as aware about how, maybe not in your home, but in larger buildings in a city that are flat, how green roofs can provide insulation and, you know, help keep your energy costs down in the summer and in the winter. And I was just wondering if you can maybe speak to that. Plus, it prevents damage to your roof, so your roofs stay more viable for a longer period of time.
Yeah, that's a great question. Green roofs, it's not something that I'm an expert in by any stretch, but I do know a little bit about it. Green roofs are a great option for commercial buildings in particular, although we do find that some people are including them on houses. It's been used in housing and other types of buildings in Europe quite extensively. They have many, many benefits, and you'll see somewhat in your general neighborhood of Wisconsin. If you look to your neighbors in Chicago, they've made some really great advances in doing green roofing on some of the buildings downtown in Chicago. And it does has a number of really great benefits. The first is, as you mentioned, it provides extra insulation to the building, so it can help keep the temperatures warmer in the winter with less heating. But it also has a great benefit in an urban area during the summertime, we find that we have something called the urban heat island effect. And that's why when you go into a city, you'll find the temperatures are, you know, 5, 10, sometimes even more than 10 degrees warmer than the surrounding suburban areas or countryside. And that's because all of the building mass, the dark rooftops, the streets, and everything else really hold in and trap heat and then give that heat off, raising the temperature in the area. And green roofs can really help lower that urban heat island effect during the summer and allow us to cut back on air conditioning bills. They have a number of other environmental benefits. They provide a great sink for rainwater and some filtering of rainwater before it hits the street, so you're not washing dust and other chemicals and materials off the roof into the water sources, and a number of other benefits. So, you know, there are a lot of studies being done around the country on the benefits of green roofs. There are a few caveats. It's sometimes difficult for an existing building, particularly an older building or a smaller home, if you're interested in pursuing this. You may need to shore up your rooftop because they do add significant weight to the building. You know, they can be a great option. There's everything from rooftop gardens that are basically like lichen and mossy type gardens that you'd find in an alpine type environment that aren't meant to be gone out onto. But then there are also rooftop green roofs that, you know, house more or less gardens that you can actually go and walk and enjoy spending time in.
Erin, thank you very much for the call and for the suggestion. We appreciate that. We're talking with Jennifer Thorne-Amon, who is a senior associate and one of three authors of the ninth edition of the Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings. That comes from the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, and it's published by New Society Publishers. That's newsociety.com. Or there is an 800 number in case you're interested in picking up a copy of that book. 800-567-6772. And we'll continue talking with Jennifer in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Thursday morning as we talk about maximizing energy and dollar savings in your home. And we're talking about the Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings, 9th edition, written by Jennifer Thorne-Amon, Alex Wilson, and Katie Ackerley. And one of the things that we didn't talk about is the number of chapters that you have in this book, Jennifer, that we should talk about, just give people a sense of what they're going to find in there, including the building envelope in Chapter 2.
Okay, yeah. We start out by talking a little bit, just giving a little context about energy efficiency in the home, the impact of a home and its energy use on the environment and on our pocketbooks, and giving some general information about carbon emissions from homes and so forth, the breakdown of energy use in a typical home, kind of where we're putting most of our energy dollars. And then in the building envelope chapter, we talk about you know, what you can do to improve the air tightness of your home, to beef up your insulation levels, issues related to windows and doors, weatherproofing, all of that type of stuff. A little bit about roofs even. And then we get into the main energy users in a building, the heating system, cooling system, water heating, and then into your major appliances, laundry, kitchen appliances, and so forth. And then we talk about lighting, electronics, and finally some of the other energy uses in the home, some of the kind of random stuff that we all have in our houses, some which are really big energy users like aquariums and waterbeds that may not be as common but are big energy users, and then the little tiny devices that we all have a lot of that may not use a lot of energy on their own, but in the aggregate are really contributing to our overall energy picture.
And then in the end, there's an appendix, more information on sources and websites, things like that, and information about ACEEE as well.
That's right. We've tried to put in a set of explanation, you know, descriptions of some other sources where you can go and find some of the products and services that can help you save energy in your home, other organizations that provide information, some government resources to help, And we also maintain this information on our website, along with kind of a condensed version of the consumer guide that has more information and direct links to some of the other resources that are highlighted throughout the book.
And what is that address again?
And it's acee.org/consumer guide.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. We have a line open if you have a question or a comment about energy savings, energy use in the home. In Madison, the number is 263-1890, and otherwise it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Judy's next in Milwaukee. Thanks for waiting, and what's on your mind, Judy?
Hi. My question is, I purchased a new dishwasher last year, and it's supposed to be the new energy efficient, but it takes over 2 hours and like 20 minutes for this to run a cycle. You know, and I always try to make sure my load is full. One of the reasons I actually timed it is I always like to catch it at the very last rinse cycle. I don't do the, you know, electric dry or any of the heat dry. I like to open it up and let that moisture get into the house, especially in the winter season.
Mm-hmm.
How is that more energy efficient when it takes so long to run through the cycle?
Well, you know, I'm not knowing exactly what dishwasher you have, Judy, it's a little hard for me to answer, but I guess there are a couple of things that it could be doing. Some of the new machines, one of the ways that they're able to save energy and save water is by using sensors to determine how dirty the water is, basically to figure out, they work to figure out on their own how dirty your dishes are, and in that way how they can adjust the cycle accordingly. So that could be some extra time that's being used in looking at, basically sensors look at the water leaving the initial rinse water that's coming out of the dishwasher and gauge how dirty that water is and whether or not it needs to go into a longer wash cycle. You know, other than that, the time that it takes to do that, you know, I really wouldn't know what to tell you. Unless, you know, it is going into a longer cycle because it's doing a lot of the work for you. And if that's the case, you know, if you're putting dishes into the dishwasher that haven't been rinsed, have only been scraped, that's exactly what we would recommend. And so even if the dishwasher is taking a bit longer to do the dishes, if it's an Energy Star model, it should be saving significantly over hand washing, even if it does end up taking a little bit longer.
Okay.
All right.
I guess I'll keep it.
All right, Judy. Thanks very much for the call, and good luck to you. It does seem that is an awfully long time.
Yeah, I would be curious to check the type of cycle to make sure, you know, it's using the lightest load cycle.
Mm-hmm.
I know one thing that you can do if you want to figure out just how good your dishwasher is, you can put in the dishes that you've only, you know, just kind of scraped off and not rinsed, and try washing on the light load, you know, the light, gentle cleaning cycle, and see if it's enough. And if it's not, you know, go up to the next level. And so you can see that way instead of saying, oh, you know, these dishes are pretty dirty, I better run it on the pots and pans cycle. Maybe try with the lightest and see what you can get away with.
On to Dave in Cumberland. Hi, Dave. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I got a curious question for your guest. Have you done any research into the LED lighting systems? I notice now the new Christmas lights are coming out LED, and our local electric cooperative has offered money back if you bought 100, you know, string light situation.
Mm-hmm.
And the rates of value saved over a period of time, like a Christmas season, they've got a formula they plugged in, so many hours and stuff like that. They said they operate at, it went from something like, $2.32 a day down to 17 cents a day.
Yeah.
Okay,
you almost think it's a typo, right?
my question is, is there anybody developing lights for the home inside using that technology? Why are we still producing the old incandescent when that technology is there and we can cut our consumption of energy by that much?
That's a great question, Dave. I'm really glad you brought this up because I know people are looking forward to the holidays and getting out their lights. So first I would say that the numbers that Dave has cited about the LED Christmas lights are absolutely true. An LED Christmas light uses a tenth or less electricity of typical incandescent or, you know, kind of the old school LED Christmas lights. I've had them for a number of years. I know they're much more widely available now and the prices are coming down. They're just a great product. They'll last much longer than the regular lamps. You don't have to worry about if one burns out, the whole string is fine. And they'll just last you for years and years. So if you go out and buy some strings this year, they could be the last Christmas lights you'll ever buy. Let's see. But moving into taking LED technology into our homes for other applications, and that's something that is, there is a lot of work going on right now to make that a reality. But there are a couple of things about the technology that are kind of funny. The way the LEDs work is it's basically an LED is a semiconductor chip that gives off light. And because of the way they can engineer these products, it's easier to make LEDs that give off colored light than white light. And so you'll see, I think many people have noticed probably throughout your listening area that there have been changes, new light traffic signals that have been put in their communities look a little bit different. The colors are a little bit different. And those are all LEDs that are saving a lot of electricity. But again, you can see that's a colored lighting application. And that's why they've done well in the holiday lights, the traffic lights, things like that. But it's a lot harder to make an LED in white light. And so that's something that a lot of work has been put into. They also are not as well suited to giving off kind of the general sort of ambient light that we like to have in our homes and buildings. So we're starting to see them being introduced more and more in flashlights, in under cabinet lighting, desktop lamps where you're trying to get specific light on a specific object. But over time, you know, the definite interest is in making general lighting that can be done with LEDs. For those kinds of general lighting applications, they still aren't quite as efficient as compact fluorescents and other fluorescent lighting technologies, but I think it's just a matter of time. So in the near term, I think that we should really shift away from incandescents, and CFLs are a great option. I think within the next decade, we're going to see a lot more options for using LEDs and maybe using LEDs in combination with compact fluorescent lamps to meet all of the lighting needs in our homes.
You do cover that in the chapter on lighting and light fixtures, and so you're right up to date on that.
That's right.
Dave, thank you very much for the call, and that explains it, and certainly within the next 5 years why we should have that answer for you. Let's go next to Monica in Milwaukee. Hello, go ahead.
Hi. I'm just so excited that this is a topic that's coming up. I drive a hybrid vehicle, the Prius, and I get like 44 miles per gallon, and I'm just in love with it. I also recently purchased Energy Saver light bulbs, and I went to Menards on, maybe a week ago, and I saw they were on sale. I was like, $7 for four of them, and I thought I'd try them out. So I changed out, you know, half the light bulbs in my house, at least the ones in the living room. And the lighting difference was just amazing. I felt like it was daytime. So I went back, and I bought, like, five more packs, and I changed all the light bulbs in my house. And I'm totally addicted to them. I'm telling everybody and all my friends that they should change over to these light bulbs. Now, is it really true that these light bulbs last for 5 years?
You know, of course, it'll depend on how much you run the lights. But just to give you an example, a typical incandescent light lasts for about 750 to 1,000 hours of operation. A compact fluorescent lamp will last anywhere from 6 to 10,000 hours. So you can see that it's definitely going to last you many times more. So if you have a light fixture that you know you're only replacing the bulb in once a year with an incandescent, then you should get at least 5 years out of that same lamp with a CFL.
Monica, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. And let's go next to Bill in Evansville. Hi, Bill.
Hi. With the compact fluorescent bulbs, my question is regarding the energy it takes to turn them on, the ballast in the bulb. And how does that relate to, like, leaving the bulb on for a little bit longer? In other words, if you're going in and out of a room, are you using up more energy just by turning the compact fluorescent on and off?
Yeah, the compact fluorescents available on the market today typically have electronic ballast, and so they're quite efficient, and there's not a real power surge to turn them on. They're still going to be saving you significantly over the incandescents. The one concern with CFLs is that if they're turned on and off a lot of times in rapid succession, it can somewhat shorten the lifetime of the bulb. So the extended life range that I was just speaking about with Monica of 6 to 10,000 hours, you may be cutting down on that overall lifetime if you are switching the lights on and off a lot. So, you know, if you really are just running out of a room for a minute or, you know, kind of making your way back and forth between a couple of rooms as you're busy doing things, then certainly leaving them on is a fine option. But, you know, I like to tell people, you know, if you think if there's a chance that you're going to be out of a room for more than 5 or 10 minutes, it makes sense to turn off the light. You certainly won't use more energy with a CFL by turning off the light if you're gone for more than, you know, more than that 5 or 10 minutes. And that way you're covered if you get distracted. I know I always get distracted, and I think I'm coming right back, and I end up spending a lot longer out of the room. Another option that's becoming increasingly available and easy to even install yourself in your own light fixtures, light switches, are occupancy sensors. And you can put in an occupancy sensor, and that way if you do have rooms where you fail to turn off the lights, or you have other family members that may be not as diligent as you are about switching them off when they leave the room, then that can really help cut down your energy use and turn off the lights if you have been gone for a while.
Okay. And we have been using CFLs for about 20 years. I think we got them when they first came out, and I know that they've helped they cost extraordinary amounts when we first bought them, like $18 or $19.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it still saved us money, even at that price.
And so if you can get four for $7, why, you know,
yeah,
the savings can be...
It's a very good deal.
Excellent. Yeah,
it's a great deal. And the other thing that I would just point out is, you know, since the time when you, as an early adopter, bought those lamps, there have been so many improvements to the technology. But also what we're starting to see come on the market more and more now are dimmable CFLs. So a lot of homes, I know people like to use their lights on dimmer switches, and they haven't been able to switch to compact fluorescents because of their limitations in working with dimmer switches. So if you have fixtures with dimmers in your home and you want to look at CFLs, go back out to the stores because they're becoming more and more widely available on the shelves, and you just want to make sure that you get one that specifically notes that it's acceptable to use with a dimmer.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. Let's give Carol in Duluth a chance. Carol, hi. What's on your mind today?
Well, I just wanted to say thanks for that comment about the dimmers, because we've been under the understanding that you can't use fluorescence with a dimmer switch, so that's good news. And then 2 points. One, is your consumer's guide directed to people who are about to build a new house, or is this mostly directed at people who are doing renovations? And then I wonder, can you repeat the 800 number where you can get the guide?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, the main audience for the book, it's really designed for the majority of people that are kind of settled in their home, how you can use the products that you already own, and the things to think about when you're replacing equipment in your home. So that's really, you know, something that's for everyone, even if you're not undertaking any major remodeling or renovations. But certainly if you are planning a remodeling project or a renovation where you're going to be installing and replacing several products, I think you'd find the book very, very helpful. The information that we have about appliances and heating and cooling equipment can also be very helpful if you're building a new home, but that's not the main target audience. I think, you know, there are some other resources out there. Unfortunately, I don't have any offhand that are designed specifically for building a new green home. But we would definitely, I think we would, you know, say that our target audience is much more people who live in existing housing.
Thank you.
Carol, thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. And let's see if we can get Jean in. Jean, go ahead.
I think your information on the LED light bulbs are it's a heavily ingrained, out-of-date information, sorry to say. You can get more information from ccrane.com. That's www.ccrane.com.
Would you spell that?
I believe the founder was Charles Crane, so they just go with the initials, the initials C, and then Crane.
Crane,
C-R-A-N-E.
Okay.
And the 800 number, I believe, is 522-TUNE, the word TUNE, T-U-N-E.
Okay.
Request a catalog. It's very, very good catalog.
All right. Thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you and getting that information. One more before we have to go would be John in Milwaukee. Hello, John.
Hi. Oh, thanks for the program. I was wondering if televisions use very much energy and if it's worthwhile to differentiate between a cathode ray tube television and a liquid LCD television.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think it's really timely. Television sets actually, they have not historically been a huge contributor to overall energy consumption, but that's really increased because people are having more and more televisions in their home, and now we're facing a situation where all of a sudden we have a lot of different television technologies to choose from, and many people will be upgrading their television in the next couple of years in preparation for the switch to digital television signals. So your question couldn't come at a better time. As it turns out, there is quite a bit of differentiation in energy use on the new television products on the market today. LCD televisions use about the same energy consumption as cathode ray or the traditional types of tube televisions that we have. Particularly for those in the traditional ranges of, in the 20 and 30 plus inch displays. Plasma screen TVs, which are, another one of the really hot new technologies, it turns out, are using substantially more energy than cathode ray tubes or the LCD, the new LCD technologies. Unfortunately, the LCD's energy savings don't continue when you get over about a 40-inch screen. So when you're getting into the larger models, we find that LCDs and plasma screens are both pretty significant energy users. One of the things that we're working to do now, and on a couple of fronts, the Energy Star program to date has focused its efforts for televisions on their standby power use, so the power use when they're off. But new Energy Star guidelines will go into place, and they should also account for the active mode power, so power across the usage cycle. And also we're hoping that we can encourage the Federal Trade Commission to develop an energy guide label like we see on our other home appliances for televisions to help consumers when you're in the market to make a comparison about the energy consumption of the products that you're looking for. So if you're in the market for a TV, a new flat-screen TV or digital television, I would really encourage you to contact the manufacturer of the models that you're interested in and ask them some very specific questions about the energy use of their products so that you know going in what the additional price tag of that machine is going to be in addition to the, $1,000-plus dollars you may be spending to buy it.
Good luck, John, and thanks very much, Jennifer. It's been a real pleasure to have you with us for the last 45 minutes.
Well, thanks, Jim. It's been great to be here.
And again, it's the 9th edition of the Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings. It's published by New Society Publishers, and you can reach them at 800-567-6772, or you can go to newsociety.com. And the website for the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy, ACEEE, is aceee.org/consumer guide on that. Our thanks for Jennifer Thorne Amon for spending time with us today. And if you'd like a CD of the program, it's available from the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program 1115F, as in Frank. I'm Jim Packard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.